Hey, guess what? Ellen's back, so I can stop reading this. But she has brought with her the friend of the show, Susan Simon, the food writer. Let's give her the clap. Oops, wrong one. Sorry about that. Sorry. Oh, there we go. Sorry, Susan. I meant to give you the other thing. Enough. Stop. Oh, the people were really excited about that. Hi, Susan.
Do you have a laugh track, too?
Yeah. We don't need that one because we generate enough laughs as it is. Right, Ellen?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. I love that. That was nice. Oh, yeah.
Should we tell Susan our new policy?
Which is?
Which she doesn't know and doesn't seem to have heard. You bring food if you want to be on the station, on the show.
I didn't know that. I didn't hear that. I was just listening to, what was I just listening to? Because I had the radio on driving here and it had something to do with, I was listening to the news and about the flu season being really.
Oh, the flu season.
Being really intense this year.
Really?
That's what I like,
the flu. I'd have no problem getting it.
Because you lose a little weight when you get
you lose a little weight. Yeah, you're not so hungry, you know. It's like a purge, you know what I mean?
Oh, please. Have you ever
it's
had
It's better
flu?
Than a colon rinse, whatever those things are called.
Oh, yes.
Remember when people were doing that crazy
stuff?
They
still
stuff?
Are. I
oh,
mean,
really?
They still are. That's colonics.
Colonics, right.
Oh, my gosh.
Disgusting.
Oh, yes.
Stupid.
No, thanks. I've learned those programs where they put you to sleep for a month or something. Or for a certain period of time.
Yeah, I think that's called death.
Oh, well, maybe I'll reconsider.
Or as being in a coma. Yeah.
No.
Like
well, anyway.
Oh, that's a new thing, right. They put you in a coma if they can't treat you right away.
Something
you know
like that.
Like if you have a really serious infection, they don't know what it is. They do a medical-induced coma.
That's why they figure it out. Yeah.
Wow.
So you don't croak.
We have that.
Well, on
to
that topic.
To.
So are you? What's today's topic? Food that puts you into a coma?
No. Well, I mean, since it's sort of this is do-it-yourself radio, hands-on radio, do-it-yourself radio. Is that correct?
Yes.
Am I correct in assuming that?
DIY, we kids say.
Oh, you kids. So I decided, since you know I write a column, unfortunately no longer in this area, but I write it for the Nantucket newspaper, and
oh, wait, that's not one. No one said it. No longer runs. Go ahead.
We love our sound effects.
Sound
here.
Effects. Is this a new toy?
Sound effects.
One of the things that I did extra this month for the Nantucket newspaper, at the request of my
circulation
of the Nantucket newspaper. I think about between 25,000 people are
really
reading this. Well, because the thing about Nantucket is. First of all, it's a once-a-week newspaper. It's a weekly. So people run for it. And it just contains all the subjects that are really interesting for Nantucketers to read once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the police blotter,
the
local
spotters.
Sports teams. The police blotters are fabulous. Yeah. And the guy that does them, he does a really good job. They're very interesting. And he does great headlines worthy of the New York Post. And you know, it's local news, and then there's a local gardening column, a local decorating column, and a local food column. And this is what people want to read. And if only Hudson had a paper like that instead of what they do.
Well, wait a second. You're saying it's a local food column, but you live in Hudson, not Nantucket.
But, you know, Hudson was founded by Nantucketers.
Okay.
You know that, don't you?
Okay.
And,
there's a connection.
There's a real connection, plus the fact that I've written two Nantucket-themed cookbooks that have remained in print for a really long time.
Yeah.
Been going to Nantucket since 1960. I consider myself part-time Nantucketer.
There
anyway, that now that we've established that, so one of the things they asked me to do for...
I know some limericks about Nantucket.
That's usually what happens as soon as you mention Nantucket, is to do a piece about my 10 favorite and recommended cookbooks of 2017 that might give people ideas of what to give.
That Otto Lengi guy didn't write another one, did he?
Yes, he did.
Oh, jeez.
And it's number one on my list.
Oh, jeez.
Who is this? What's the guy's name?
Yotam Ottolenghi.
Oh, no wonder I didn't remember it.
I think that...
What's he, like once a year now, a cookbook?
I don't know if it's once a year, but he's prolific. I mean,
is this an Italian person?
He's Israeli. He lives in London, but he's Ottolenghi is an Italian Jewish name, and his father was from Italy, his mother from Germany, and they came to Israel in 1939. So he's a Sabra. He was born in Israel, but his background. He said there are this whole group of Italian Jews that went to Israel in the right before the war broke out, created this area of Tel Aviv that's called Little Tuscany. which I didn't know about, having never been to Israel. Have you?
No.
No. So anyway, he his food, which makes him, you know, there are a lot of things that make him a very interesting restaurateur and author, and I won't dwell on it. But the fact that he is has this very, very interesting background, and he is an he started out his life as an academic. I mean, some kind of obscurology was his major. And then he realized that his great love was pastry making, and then from pastry making, he started these sort of high end delis in London, and then his and cookbooks and fame.
So what's his new one about?
So these are my ten, and I break them up into categories. Books that are my absolute favorites from 2017, books that I recommend, books that are on my wish list, and books for fans of well-known food personalities, because, okay, you know, bloggers and television stars always have cookbooks. So my absolute favorite is number one is Sweet, which is Yotam Ottolenghi's new book written with a longtime collaborator of his, an Australian called Helen Goh. I think it's G-O-H. How would you pronounce that? Goh?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. And this is, I'll just read what I wrote about it, and then we can talk about it. The recipes, like the recipes in all of the Ottolenghi books, these recipes for sweets use seemingly disparate ingredients to put a tasty spin in classical recipes and new ones too. One of the recipes that I had shared in a previous column was his recipe for halva and tahini brownies.
Oh,
which were,
halva brownies,
as a friend of mine said, it was the best thing he's ever eaten. They were supremely rich chocolate brownies with very little flour, lots of butter, eggs, chocolate, cocoa powder, and then chunks of halva mixed in with it, and then tahini drizzled on top.
Mm. Have you made these?
I made them. I have a photograph somewhere.
I want to see actual.
They were. I may have to remake them this winter, because they are.
Well, save us some.
I will. They are unbelievably delicious. But the book is just filled with stuff like that. You know, who would think to crumble up because chocolate covered tahini is delicious. Mm-hmm. I mean, halva, but to take them and put chunks of them into a brownie mix and then to drizzle the tahini on top, sesame and chocolate. They're delicious. So there are a couple of things that are on my wish list in that book, and one is an apricot and amaretto cheesecake. And another is a chocolate tart with hazelnut, rosemary, and orange.
Wow.
So what I was thinking to talk about today is, you know, I'll go through my list of favorite cookbooks and perhaps suggest not only giving the cookbook, perhaps a piece of a cooking equipment to go with it. So in the case of this book on sweets, a tart pan with collapsible sides. You've got one.
Two of them.
Yeah, good. Or a springform pan.
Oh, who doesn't have that already?
You see?
How could you cook without a springform pan?
I have one.
You have one? You say a springform
pan. I've used it maybe once, maybe twice.
You can't make a cheesecake without a springform pan.
Oh, that's why I haven't made a cheesecake.
So it's stuff like that. You know, consider, you know, not only giving the book, but perhaps giving a piece of equipment that may make one of the recipes.
I'm giving my wife one of those fake pasta out of vegetables.
Oh, a swirly.
Do you get on late night television?
I don't know. It costs about $5 somewhere. I don't know. It probably doesn't work.
Yeah, so you're gonna
make a big spender.
Zucchini posing as fettuccine.
It's a way to get eat vegetables.
Oh, is that what it is?
Is what they're saying.
Yeah. I have in one of my books, a recipe for zucchini posing as fettuccine with lemon cream sauce.
Yeah.
But I make the ribbons just taking a vegetable peeler and peeling it down. Yeah, and making ribbons. Anyway, and the other of my absolute favorites, and it's a book called King Solomon's Table, and it's by Joan Nathan, who has written many, many, many books on Jewish cooking. And King Solomon's Table is, she goes all around the world and talks about the food of the Jews all over the world, because although as strange as it may seem, a lot of people who think Jewishness is a race, it's actually a religion. So there are Jews all over the world.
And part of that religion is eating Chinese food.
Part of that religion on Christmas and then going to the movies.
Eating Chinese food.
But she opens the book in Kerala in southern India, in Kochi, where there's a big Jewish population. So some of her recipes that are like Ben Israel fish curry with fresh ginger, tamarind, and cilantro, Indian chicken with cardamom, cumin, and cilantro. And then she goes to Sicily, where she does fideos tostados, which is toasted pasta in a cinnamon-spiked tomato sauce. I mean, putting cinnamon in tomato sauce, which is very southern Italian, with toasted pasta. Can you imagine? I mean, I'm drooling about this. So you go all around. I mean, you know, there's a whole Jewish population in Ethiopia. So there's just all over the world. There are Chinese Jews.
Yeah. The Ethiopian Jews claim to be one of the last tribes. Mm-hmm. Lost tribes.
Lost tribes, yeah. And there are a lot of Ethiopians and Somalians in Israel now, too.
Hmm.
And there's that special spin on, you know, the cuisine. So I find this an extremely interesting book because I'm very interested in books that give you not only the recipes but tell you the provenance, the history, you know, anecdotal information. I wanted the cookbook to be a good read, not just the recipes. And then books that I recommend, and these are books that have received that I don't own yet but have received great press and personal reviews, and they seem to be, out of the books that I recommend, two of them, the authors are alums of Chez Panisse. Chez Panisse seems to have produced a lot of very good chefs, cooks, mm-hmm. and authors, including one that we have right here in Hudson at Talbot and Harding, on the Talbot. And this book, which is called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, the author is Samin Hostrat, and she worked at alum of Chez Panisse, and her book is highly illustrated, showing step by step. This is something that used to happen in cookbooks, that there used to be beautiful illustrations, and then it became, you know, these lush photographs. And I think there's a kind of return to illustrated books, and this one is a very good example. And what she does,
drawings of the stages,
is there drawings of the stages of the food, yeah. and, you know, mm-hmm. beautifully done by the illustrators called Wendy McNaughton. And the New York Times wrote that this book is a go-to resource for matching the best techniques with the best ingredients. And an example would be in the heat section, the author talks about different ways heat can be generated and how will it affect your ingredients. You know, on the stovetop, on a grill, or in the oven. Mm. So you grill a vegetable, you roast a vegetable, you bake a bit. You know, they're, and the flavor is.
And of course, the different pans you use and all that stuff matters
absolutely,
too, right?
Absolutely. And what I put for a suggestion for this to go along with this book is either a gun. Or something that's like a chapa, which is one of those grills that you put on top of a grill that has corrugated on one side and flat on the other side, like a griddle, which I think are incredibly useful. I use it on my outdoor grill all the time because it heats to an intense heat and just kind of, but you're going to get seared and crispy gold and vegetables. It's a wonderful piece.
I'll stick with my George Foreman.
I want
the grill marks.
You want the grill marks. I tell the television. I have a timer.
Rich food. You're eating all that rich food. It keeps you up late.
Is that what it is?
Chocolate? Chocolate doesn't keep you awake?
It does eat chocolate. It's really hard. The chocolate I like to have for breakfast. So I have the whole day to work it all. Another book that's in this highly recognized, David Tanis worked at Chez Panisse for 25 years, and he now lives in a weekly column for the New York City Kid, if you've ever read him in the Wednesday paper. And what I said about his book, it's their mantra for find the best ingredients, learn their qualities, then show them off via their recipes. And his book is called David Tanis Market Cooking, Recipes and Revelations, Ingredient by Ingredient. There are so many books that that use this subject to educate people about the ingredients. I mean, in the book I just mentioned, it's educating people about different ways of cooking things, you know, how to generate heat. Here, Tanis talks about getting to know your ingredient and then what to do with it.
I've always been interested in how to generate heat.
Oh, Tom, sorry. Just take one look at you.
No, I'm talking about cooking. Don't get me wrong.
And so he divides his chapters are divided in a non-traditional way. They are divided by ingredients. Like there's a chapter called Alliums United, and they are in-depth explanations of something he calls always garlic. That's the first thing. Onions, leeks, shallots, and scallions. And so he's taking, giving you an in-depth, you know, immersion in category of vegetable and then giving lots of recipes. And he's basically giving you recipes that are, you know, traditional recipes, like in this Allium category of Spanish garlic toast for breakfast, which
it's going to make you a lot of friends during the day.
What? It's a Provençal garlic soup, which is delicious. Sometimes put in a poached egg into it. A scordalia, which is it's the Greek potato and garlic dip, if you had that. You know about scordalia?
No. There's a whole world out there.
Well, scordalia is kind of what it uses. It's kind of something you find in all Greek restaurants and have been forever, right up there in their category of little appetizers. It's a delicious thing.
Ellen likes that green spinach dip thing that people...
that put inside a potato, a loaf of bread?
Loaf.
I've never seen this, but right. I'd be willing to sample it and try it.
I think you can get it already packaged out at ShopRite.
I'm way back with onion crudités. Soup and sour cream. Yes. Remember the dried onion soup
and sour cream?
And sour cream.
It's delicious with potato chips?
Yeah.
I used to when I had my catering business, I used to sort of make I couldn't quite give my clients onion soup with sour cream, so I did. I crisped up to tons of shallots and then mixed it with ricotta and sour cream to make
a
dip.
It was just a better version.
It was a better version, but the idea was there. I served it with potato chips. Why not? But
sure.
Anyway, the next book on my recommended is the Sullivan Street Bakery Cookbook, Jim Leahy. Now, do you know about Jim Leahy and the Sullivan Street Bakery in New York City? Jim Leahy, a couple of years ago, gave everybody via the New York Times a recipe for no-knead bread that became all the rage. Hmm. Do you remember this? Do you remember this happening?
No.
Everybody made it. It was a bread that you really didn't have to knead. You just kind of threw the flour and the yeast together, and you let it sit there overnight, or you let it sit there for 18 hours, and then you put it in an olive-oiled casserole in the oven. And you let it cook, and it just rose all by itself, and it made this gorgeous loaf of bread. And just before it was finished, you pulled it out, and you splashed olive oil all over it, and it would sizzle. Mm. Put it back in for a little while, and it made the perfect loaf of bread. And it sort of...
Wow.
His bakery, which was on Sullivan Street, and it opened in 1994 when I was, like, in the middle of, you know, having my catering business. So I used to get my bread from him. He also made a very famous, very, very thin-crusted pizza that people would come in and buy by the slab.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really a slab because it was thin, but, you know, by the piece. And he parlayed that business. He's a character. I mean, in the early years, Jim was always in the bakery full of interesting ideas and takes on the world. Sullivan Street, there is still a bakery on Sullivan Street where his original bakery was. It's not called Sullivan Street Bakery anymore. He's moved to the Way West Side in Midtown, and he has a cafe bakery there and a big bakery because he wholesales his bread. But he's also, this is his second cookbook, and it's, you know, not only recipes for bread, but also the kinds of things that he serves that go with bread, things that are that he serves at his cafe. Things like apple bread pudding, and he has something in there that's not quite bread, but he calls it l'amico di pollo, the friend of chicken, which is an adorable name for something that's a side dish that goes with chicken, and it's roasted turnips. There's also a recipe in the book for a chickpea fritter and tahini sandwich, which served on his bread. His bread is that kind of thick, crusty loaf with a beautiful, soft crumb. Delicious. So I would suggest if you were to buy this book for somebody, you would buy them something like a proofing basket, which is sometimes called a Benetton. Not Benetton, but a Benetton. And you have one of those probably, Tom, don't you?
No.
No.
You'd need a very large kitchen or pantry to store all of these dishes.
You think you do until you live in a New York City kitchen and you start stacking
things.
You know, when I closed my catering business at its commercial side, I ran my catering business out of my New York City apartment kitchen for quite a few years afterwards. And I did it. You do it.
Yeah.
You find a way. The biggest problem is refrigeration. But in the wintertime, that wasn't a problem because I had an outdoor garden. I put things outside. The next book that I recommend is this all right if I just keep blabbing on?
Mm. Yes. It making me very hungry, but...
Do I get an opinion?
Yes.
No. I mean, you could speed it up a little bit, maybe.
Speed it up?
Yeah.
I don't know if I can talk... Tell me how much more time I have.
We're only on the third book.
No.
No. We're like seven
one,
or eight.
One, two... Three, four, five. Oh, we're halfway through.
I'm sorry. I must have been asleep. Sorry. No, nothing personal. I'm really tired. I've been in meetings all day. I just wasn't. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'll talk to you.
We're with the bread guy.
Is our local author on this list, by the way?
There are no local authors' books out.
Oh, the pasta woman.
Oh, right.
I guess that means no.
I have to.
The pasta one.
I don't know that book.
Backpack pasta or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yes. The next book on the list is Tartine, Modern Recipes for the Home Cook. And I put Tartine on this purely. I mean, it's a good book, and it'll be on other lists besides mine. It's by Elizabeth Pruitt, who is a pastry chef and the co-founder of San Francisco's Tartine Bakery, which is like one of the great bakeries also. Do you know? Tom knows about that. Have you been there?
No.
Chad, her husband.
I'm not
Chad.
A foodie anymore. I was for a while, but I gave it up.
You gave it up. Well, there's a
limit to how much you can read, and you know, I mean, not for you, obviously, but I get tired of reading about food. It doesn't really. At some point, if you're not really cooking a lot and everything, it's just like.
As I said, I like.
I know
I
it's your life. I'm not saying it's wrong.
No, it's absolutely not wrong.
Right.
I'm doing a little thing about. Cookbooks for Christmas presents is
you know I mean?
Absolutely right.
But I know, but you've never had a period in your life where you're just like, okay, I just can't.
You know,
even
before I was in the food business, I've always been interested in food. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've come from, you know, it's not that my mother was, you know, an outstanding cook. She was a good provider of mm-hmm. food every night. There were no TV dinners on our menus. I mean, they probably weren't invented when I was a child, but there was good food. My maternal grandmother was a great intuitive cook. And then I went to live in Italy, you know, when mm-hmm. I was, mm-hmm. before I was 20 years old, and that just did it.
I guess I misrepresented. It's not that I'm not interested in food. I'm definitely interested, and I insist on good food all the time. It's just that a certain amount of, you know, the culture of being... You know, this whole foodie thing gets a little.
It does get a little bit, and the amount. You know, I thought that perhaps this year when my editor asked me to do this, my favorite 10 books, I thought, oh my God, how am I going to choose? Because I don't think that there were many outstanding books this year. But then I started to do some research, and there were like an enormous amount of cookbooks published. And I think publishers will tell you the cookbooks are still. The kinds of books that sell.
That's sort of hard to believe sometimes because you wonder, what new can you do?
And as I just said, when I was talking about David Tanis's mm-hmm. book, how many different ways do you talk about ingredients?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's an aphorism in writing, and I think it holds for any kind of book, that you can tell the same story many different ways.
Sure.
So I think that's what's happening.
We interviewed last year a local person who wrote a book on butter. And I liked it a lot because it was a book that actually had a historical and social context to it and all that kind of stuff, you know? So it was pretty interesting. It had some recipes, but You know, it had more than just recipes and pictures.
Yeah, it wasn't written as a cookbook at all.
I just interviewed Alan Newman, who you know, who's from the Historic Hudson, right? Okay. And, you know, he's making marmalade now. Here's this, you know, a preservation architect, I guess. And,
so he claims, yeah.
Anyway.
No, I don't know. I have no idea.
So it, but, yeah, I think food holds interest to many, many people. And they, I mean, I'm talking about Yotam at the beginning of this. I mean, his he was an academic. He was deeply academic. Both his parents are professors in Israel. Mm-hmm. But he was just seduced by pastry. And, but he, with his brilliant mind, he parlayed it into an, his own little industry.
Remember when you found all these cookbook authors to appear at the Hudson Farmers Market? And we would have them on the program occasionally, and they would give us a cookbook.
They didn't give us food.
Or or else I would buy the cookbook. It looked so interesting and whatever. I, you know, now what do I do with all these cookbooks? They're on the shelf. I don't use them.
Donate them to the library.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. As you say, there are so many produced, and they're really...
Really, when I moved
they're
here,
they're beautiful. That's one thing that attracts me to
food
them.
Porn.
I mean, when I moved here, I just because I lived not far from the Strand, so I would take my little shopping cart and just wheel overloaded cartfuls of books to the Strand, sell them, and you know really thinned out my cookbook collection. And I came here and I just filled it right back up again.
I think I gave you a couple.
Yes.
Cookbooks.
Yes. And
I have more because I've got to get rid of, I need more space for books that I use instead of.
Now, if you're truly a dedicated foodie, wouldn't you be able to come up with a lot of this on your own?
Oh, you can come up. Of course you can. I mean, in the end, I mean, I read these cookbooks, I look at them and most of them are inspirational. Mm-hmm. The recipe, you know, the books that I really use are the first two that I mentioned. You know, I use Ottolenghi. Mm-hmm. There are some books that I use. And I especially use books for baking because they're such precise measurement. But I do, you know, I've written many cookbooks myself. So I mean, I know how to do them. I know all this. Yeah. I mean, I can't say I know all this stuff, but I know, I have a good idea what different kinds of heat, what they generate in food, what an ingredient will do, what a spice will do. So yes, most of the food that I cook is something that, you know, I'm inspired by an ingredient I find in the farmer's market or something like that. But I also get very inspired by, I mean, I look at these cookbooks and I, as I said, I like to read the author's point of view, the history. Mm-hmm. And as far as this, I'll go back to this tartine book for a minute. When I was in San Francisco last year, I ate at Tartine Manufactory, which is now... There were Bar Tartine, and there were a couple of tartines all around San Francisco, and it's all been amalgamated into this one huge factory down in the I forget what district that is, but it's where they bake all their bread. That's where they have a restaurant, they have a gelateria, they have all theirs in one big factory. And the dessert I had, but it seemed to be the desserts I was having all over California at the time because it was winter, and it was the seasonal recipe, which was sticky date pudding. And theirs won the prize. I mean, I ate it at Jalina in L.A., and I ate it at a couple other places. It was outstanding. It was sticky date pudding with hot toffee sauce. And the recipe is in this book. And for me, the recipe is worth the price of the book, just to have that one recipe. And that's what a publisher or an editor will tell you, too. If you get one or two good recipes out of a book, it's worth it. Stuff that you'll use over and over and over again.
I do use Marcella Hazan's Essentials of Italian Cooking.
Marcella Hazan, yeah, I go back to the, you know, and I said that one recent column that I wrote. I said you know I always put the when I write a recipe, I'll give you the author, the publisher, and the year it was published. And most of the recipes go back to the 90s or the early aughts. I mean, when a recipe is good, it's good. I mean, there's a I find myself going back to So I also thought that to go along with the tartine book, a nice pepper grinder, because she gives a very good recipe for roasted chickpeas, cacio e pepe, which is roasted chickpeas with grated cheese and lots of freshly ground black pepper.
Sounds good.
And then, Tom, we're down to my last one.
I wasn't trying to, you know,
My last four books.
Oh, okay.
We have time?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so these books are the wish list books. Ah. They're aspirational books. And one is called On Vegetables, Modern Recipes for the Home Kitchen. And this is also by a California chef called Jeremy Fox. And he cooked at a very well-known restaurant in Los Gatos, which is outside, it's in the peninsula outside of San Francisco, called Manresa. I don't know if you heard it, but it was the early years of local ingredients, and it was kind of a step towards the modernist kind of cooking. It wasn't quite what Noma in Denmark is, but it was, you know, taking food and experimenting. It was not quite what El Bulli in Spain was, where, you know, everything was in aerated containers or gelatinized, but he was close. But anyway, he's a very interesting chef, and now he has a restaurant in Santa Monica. But the book is very beautiful. It's Faden Publishing. I don't know if you know Faden as a publisher, mm-hmm. but they make big, beautiful books, big, beautiful, expensive books. And this one is one of those.
How many shelves do you have devoted to these cookbooks?
You've been downstairs in my house. Upstairs is a room that, because the house was a two family house, so upstairs the room that was like the living room, I turned into a library office. So I've got bookshelves both sides, and it's spilling out. I've got to edit again. I got to edit and get rid of some of them. But anyway, this book is just, he gives his spin on you know, what can be done with vegetables. And it's beautifully illustrated. And it's just it's like a coffee table cookbook. And the next one that's on my wish list is called Istanbul and Beyond, Exploring the Diverse Cuisine of Turkey. Mm-hmm. And this is also a very beautiful book. And I have never been to Turkey. And it's always been a place that I used to have dreams about Istanbul, and you know,
my wife loved
fantastic.
My wife loved the food in Turkey.
The food in Turkey is meant to be out of this world. I mean, at best. I don't know if Turkey is the safest place to go anymore. I'm not sure.
That's a while back, but
yeah,
the hotel food was unbelievable.
I think that it's one of those places where it's hard to have a bad meal. And these authors live in Italy, and they've traveled to over 20 years. They've traveled to Turkey a lot, and as I say here, the wife is the author, and her husband photographed it. And she, for example, some of the recipes, I say they announce themselves in color, like hot pink pickled cabbage, purple basil cooler, fragrant orange cookies, buttery apricots with walnuts, and tomato and pomegranate relish. But I think Turkey is about a lot about vegetables. I mean, while you get fish, and I think they're very famous for their mussels, especially in Istanbul. I think that this is just a way to travel to Turkey through a book. Mm-hmm. I also think, going back to why I like cookbooks, I think you can learn a lot about a place by the food that they eat. It tells you a lot. And so the last two cookbooks are books for people who are fans of, and I put down Spit and Kitchen Every Day Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. And Spit and Kitchen is probably one of the most popular food blogs. Do you know about Spit and Kitchen?
No.
It is a highly viewed and food blog, and the author.
What's the first word?
Smitten.
Oh, smitten.
Yeah, I thought she said spitten. Didn't you, Ron?
Yeah,
I could tell
I
you
did.
Smitten. You were really disgusted with the notion that it was spitten. I could see that on your face.
Smitten Kitchen, and the author of it is Deb Perelman, and she's won many awards for her blog, and her claim to fame is she cooks all her food again in. No surprise, in a very small New York City apartment kitchen. Uh-huh. Since her fame, she's been able to move to a larger New York City apartment. She's also gotten married and had children, but I still think it's not like a kitchen would be in a country house. Mm. But she, you know, she makes food that's available to everybody.
Have you met the Vogue food writer who's living
in town? Who lives here?
Yeah.
She's called Tamar.
Tamar, yeah.
No, I haven't met her yet, but I,
Tamar,
you know,
Adler,
I have to.
I think is her
name. Do you know her?
No, I just met her. I'm just curious if you follow her work at all.
I read Vogue, yeah. Mm. Even though I think Vogue needs a new editor, it's time for Anna to go, but that's just
You see that, Ellen? She referred to Anna Wintour by her first name.
Yeah,
it's very insiderish.
No, but it's like, I'm sorry, that was a real...
Catty?
It wasn't. It was, just my opinion. Okay. I've been reading Vogue for a long time.
There
are probably
a lot of people who agree with you.
I think it needs a new point of view. I think Tamar's work is very good. I like it very much,
okay.
And I would like to meet her. And we have mutual friends, so that day will come. It'll come because it'll come organically.
So we're down to the last book.
Yes. Tom is such a gracious host, isn't he?
He is.
That's what people say.
That's not all they say.
No, definitely not.
Okay.
So the last book is called 5 Ingredients: Quick and Easy Food. And it's by Jamie Oliver.
Oh, that's
and Jamie Oliver is big popular television personality.
Yeah.
Mostly, I mean, he started in Great Britain. He still is in Great Britain. And the thing I like about Jamie Oliver, apart from the fact that he's kind of an amusing personality, he is a passionate food activist. And he's the one that has started, you know,
dedicated school
food.
Yeah, that's good.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I do this. I think you do it, too. Hudson Reed's.
Yes.
And I sit there and I see what this kid's eating, and I just want to just sometimes it smells so bad. I don't know what to do because I really want to gag. And it's just like I cannot. And now the latest thing. And then someone told me it's not so new, but it was new to me. Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in a plastic bag.
Yes.
That comes, you know, from the
from
maker,
Welch's jelly.
From Welch's jelly.
Yeah. Yes. In a cellophane bag.
In a cellophane bag. To be opened.
Not even a homemade peanut butter, but probably comes in a huge box.
Right. So you can imagine the kind of...
The bread is probably, you know, 150 years old.
Right. But what they probably use, you know, to keep it alive or whatever you call it, you know, the additives in there.
No,
it's just,
I mean,
the whole thing is so gross. It's just, I can't understand it.
No, this is something that we talk, you know, we're doing, you know, this literacy program, and we're reading to kids, and we're reading with kids. I mean, there's something to be said about food literacy too, and that's, you know, they don't spend very much money on food in the public schools. That's that's the problem. It's something to be tackled, but that's one. I mean, not only is this book an interesting book.
Start another organization. We need an organization.
We need another organization for people to donate their money to in this little town of ours. So, Jamie,
you know, I bet the biggest obstacle are the people who work in the kitchens.
I think the biggest obstacles is the government. You know, exactly. You know, and how much food. There are organizations all over the country that school by school, step by step, are dedicated to improving the food in school. But it's
But don't you think the people in the kitchens have a lot to do with, you know, looking for convenience and speed and all that kind of stuff?
I think that could be part of it, but I think the people that are in the kitchens, you know, it's a job, and they do
what they're instructed
to do.
Yes.
So this book is, you know, a way to continue to support Jamie Oliver, and it's a companion book to a television program that he has in England. I don't know, it may come here, but there are really good, quick and easy recipes in this book that use only 5 ingredients, and one of them, for example, is a smoky chorizo salmon, prosciutto celeriac salad. Celeriac is that?
Oh, I know. My wife served it at Thanksgiving. Remember?
She did.
Mm-hmm.
How did she do it?
I don't know. It was equally as ugly as the vegetable itself is.
It's delicious.
It's the ugliest. You will agree. It's the ugliest looking thing.
It's gnarly.
It was okay. It was okay.
But I think it's delicious. I love celeriac.
Yeah, it's okay.
I mean, I like it raw in a salad.
Do you remember how it was, Ellen? Was it,
I don't remember.
I think it probably had a stock in it. I don't know.
Or you know. I again, when I had a catering business, I used to make, there's a south of France recipe of celery root and apples mashed. And it comes out, it's like silky. It looks like mashed potatoes, but it's apples and
right.
celery root.
I
it's
remember
not potatoes.
She said she was at the farmer's market and said she couldn't resist it. She saw the celeriac. And I said, yeah, because it looks so beautiful, you had to get it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the ugliest. You've seen what it looks like, right, Ellen?
Yeah, well, it's a root.
Yeah, not all roots are that ugly.
Anyway, but also it's celery.
I've seen some very handsome beets. Not to mention turnips that I, you know, would take out on a date. I'm making Ellen laugh, even if not you, Susan. So
I'm just trying. I'm trying to imagine a turnip out on a date with you.
She was a turnip, all right.
Yes. So that's it. I mean, I have a. I do have a bonus thing, a bonus one. But
okay.
I like this five ingredients idea. What are some of his
give me one recipes? This prosciutto and celery act salad. Celeriac raw, and you peel it and grate it. There's a very famous French dish called celery root remoulade that's kind of delicious. Mm. It's like a slaw. It's like a celery root slaw. And, you know, there's a lemony mustardy mayonnaise with shredded celery root. It's good. You can take it and stuff it inside a piece of boiled ham, wrap it as a nice little appetizer. Pretty delicious.
I had a revelation about celery in general at a local restaurant when they were serving a celery salad that just blew me away.
I know exactly which celery salad you're talking about.
It's like, whoa, that's celery I'm eating, and it's delicious.
I've had that celery salad.
What else
amazing.
Was in it?
I know. What?
Amazing.
What else was in it?
Had crumbled peanuts on top.
Crumbled peanuts. I think there were some capers. It was a white kind of dressing, not heavy dressing, but a nice dressing. It was just delicious. It was just unbelievable.
And really fresh.
And they knew I loved it so much that when they took it off the menu, they said, "We have sad news for you. We took it off the menu for a while." But that's okay.
Celery is one of those great things you can, you know, to make a salad with in the middle of the winter when there's not a lot of other fresh ingredients.
Where did you have this?
I thought I'd keep that information. You know, it sounds like I'm promoting a friend's restaurant, Little Deb's.
Delicious.
Okay.
So, yeah.
They make awesome salads. They have this, I forget what the slaw is based. It's a cabbage slaw salad that's got a real hot spice to it. It's delicious. I think it may even have a little chorizo in it. It's really good.
I was going to go tonight, but then I was told that it's a different, it's like queer chicken night or something.
What?
Which, you know, it's fine, but I think it'll be too really crowded, so.
What do you mean? It's a special. I was going to go there myself tonight, but now that I know you're going.
I'm not going.
Oh, you're not going? Oh, okay.
Because it's going to be too. You go.
What do you mean? What is this queer chicken thing?
I don't know. They have different theme nights.
Oh, it's a theme night. Mm. It's Thursday, though. Okay. Never mind.
But they do make really good salads, and, you know, they have a very good way with vegetables at that restaurant, particular restaurant in Hudson. Okay, so those are my.
So is our friend Gabby?
Huh?
Have you been enjoying our friend Gabby's?
I haven't been there yet.
You haven't been there yet?
You mean it's a hotel?
Yeah.
Is it good?
Oh yeah, he's got a couple just incredible dishes.
See, you're much richer than I am, so you can go out more than I do.
That's because I deny myself so many other things.
Oh.
Like clothes. Car, house.
And this is just speaking off the top of my head. I'm not pointing fingers at anything. But I was in the city for a few days last week, and I had an appointment in Madison Square Park, so I could walk from Penn Station to Madison Square Park. But I walk in a way that there are a bunch of really interesting restaurants around Broadway in the high 20s, and. One of them is April Blumenfeld's restaurant, John Dory, which is a fish restaurant in the Ace Hotel on Broadway and 29th. And I just popped in there, it's like 2 o'clock for lunch. And I got a fried mussel po' boy, you know, plump mussels, deep fried on a beautiful piece of bread, full of delicious tartar sauce and all kinds of leaves, $16. So I walked out of a really attractive.
Well, this has always been the truth about New York restaurants. If you want to eat without a big budget, you know, in your limited budget, eat lunch in New York City, not dinner.
Right, and you can because that I think lunch is like the lost leader.
Right.
It's the advertisement for their dinner.
They just want to get people in.
So, but the thing is, I feel you can't do that here in this town.
We don't have a good lunch situation right now.
And if you do find something, you don't get out for much less than $15 or $20.
Right.
Which is, and it's not bright and cheery, usually. I mean, there are some really good places. I mean, but Little Deb stopped serving lunch, which is a shame.
For the winter, I guess, if it's a...
Oh, yeah?
But, you know, people used to ask me why I was driving a 20-year-old beat-up Honda,
mm-hmm.
and it was so I could eat out dinner more often. What would you rather do, make car payments or eat out now and then?
Oh, I completely eat out more. I mean, you know, there's so many things that I would rather do, but, you know, I don't have the income I used to. What can I say? Mm. So
hang out with Ellen.
Yeah, with Ellen, I have to find...
You may have heard earlier. She was sitting here opening her weekly checks from all over.
Anyway, that's what I have to say.
It's that time of year.
The time of the year. I mean, no. I don't, and I also, you know, it's the time of the year when everybody's asking you for money for charities and this and that, and they're doing the blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Well, I see that one of your other projects in life was got a nice grant. The Hudson Book. Aren't you part of the big Hudson Book Festival?
Oh, the Book Festival got a really nice grant, yes. But and we're the you know, the Literacy Fund, which is a support to the Book Festival. And we've been doing some grant writing too, and getting some.
There was a. House tour,
right?
That was benefited your project.
It benefited the book festival, really. I mean, we were on the advertisement for purely for other reasons,
right?
Right. What's the other? Wait, you said the book festival. What's the other? That's your tour.
We're
right?
The Hudson, the Literacy Fund, which is support to the book festival. So we as our Literacy Fund do things like. All the good fours the kids get so they can get free books every year. We supply those. We've got some programs in the schools like the Thumbs Up Award, which now that you're a mentor, you see that in the schools. Last year we started the Young Writers Program in the high school, which we're bringing back
mm-hmm.
by request.
I went to the reading. It was fantastic.
It was really good.
A lot of fun.
But we're the Hudson Children. I mean, it's very confusing because the name that was chosen, the Hudson Children's Book Festival Literacy Fund, and we're trying to highlight the fact that we're the Literacy Fund, which is a support to the book festival.
Oh, okay. I was confused.
But yes, we're very closely aligned, and mm-hmm. you know, Lisa Dolan, who's the book festival, is also on our board, and so she did make that announcement of the great grant they just got. Good grant.
Great.
And we're doing, you know, a little grant writing too. We're getting, you know, small amounts.
You may have heard earlier in the first part of the show, Ellen's working on a grant. Your cat place.
Oh,
you were
yeah, Ellen's cat house. Because
now, what kind of a...
Well,
no, for actual cats.
cats.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
Cats are discriminated against.
That's what Sarah
against.
Huckabee Sanders said the other day.
Yeah, I heard that, yeah, yeah. Even though that was like, yeah, right.
Sorry, I'm sorry, Ellen.
I don't know.
So it's for cats that...
Well...
I need therapy.
Cats need to be taken care of.
Yeah.
You know. Unlike, I mean, dogs, all the emphasis is on dog parks.
Well, you know, Ellen
so
was...
what about a cat house?
Right, and she was responding to this, like, endless flood of grants that have been going on everywhere. You know, it's like, we want to get in on it, you know?
So it's a cat house. Cat house.
I actually invented it for her on the air, but Ellen went along with it. I was really kind of surprised. I was very pleased by that. And, because, you know, she has two, and she would like to, you know, beef it up a little bit, so to speak. Bring in more cats.
Are you kidding?
Yes.
Do your cats go outside?
Yes. They do. They're indoor, outdoor cats. But I've heard more critters in the nighttime recently. I live over above Power Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
So you're and close to the woods.
There are coyotes.
There's
a red fox who comes around all the time. The red fox is beautiful.
You see them over in... the prison park there, too. You know, the park on... Mm-hmm.
And deer, of course, and skunk and all kinds of things.
I get them, too, because I back up on woods. And my wife put the pumpkins out. Boy, those animals just
thought it was
tore
nice
them
snack.
Apart.
Huh? Nice snack, huh?
Yeah.
Yep.
No, I don't think I have a woodchucks. Ugh.
Oh, and woodchucks are very destructive.
Ugh, and my dog just barks at them. He goes mano a mano with them.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
You want a dog park, Susan? Are you happy with what's...
No, I really want a dog park because, you know, I'm not doing...
Can we use your backyard?
teach my dog to use my backyard. This dog brings me out 3 times a day, snow, sleet, rain, ice. He likes to run, and he's no place to run except illegally.
No, the part you can you can't let him loose, right?
Right.
But you can take him down.
Now you can take him to the Hudson River
Hudson Park.
Yeah, but
he cannot run.
No, yes, I want a dog park, but I it's a very That's very long. That's another long discussion.
We'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. As your future Common Council President, I'll figure it out personally. You're right. No, I mean, this...
There are a lot of things that I would like you to figure out.
Oh, jeez, it's already starting. See? I knew it. Why did I bring it up? I deserve that.
This does not mean that this program is going to be political.
Right.
Yeah. And one of the things people, if they want something from the government, do not come on the show.
Well, I'm on the show, but I didn't ask, but as you brought it up.
No, I didn't. No, it was my mistake. It was definitely my mistake. We have to say goodbye, Ellen.
We do. This has been the Thursday Afternoon Show, it being Thursday.
And who's our guest been? I've forgotten her name.
Our guest has been the lovely Susan Simon, who is a regular on this show, and she's a food journalist.
Thank you.
Among other things, and she's, I just love talking about food with you.
Thank you.
We will accept samples.
Make those brownies.
Oh my God.
This, I'm going to go away for almost 3 weeks now, but when I come back.
That would be nice. Hey, I'm going to Chicago. I've been looking. See, I fake it. Actually, you know, when I'm going to a city, I look up, you know, what's happening.
Good restaurants in Chicago.
Yeah, I know. And a lot of them got special attention recently, and I'm going to check some of them out.
Are you really going to Chicago?
Yeah.
You're not going to be here for the holidays?
You're going to cry?
Well, no.
Then your daughter lives in Chicago?
Yeah. My soon-to-be bearing my grandchild daughter. On that note, we say goodbye. I'm Tom DiPietro. This is that voice you hear in the background. It's the lovely Ellen Thurston. And, of course, our guest, Susan Simon. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM.